feel like. I'm taking a long time to get to my point, so here it is. Hard things come along. They always have, and they always will. When that time comes, you have to turn toward Jack and not away from him. And that's not in your nature. You love the man, don't bother blushing. I know you love him, even if you can't say the word in your own mind. But your first instinct will be to shut him out. So be aware of that, and do what you can to stop yourself. Anna tried to smile. It made sense that Aunt Quinlan would worry about such things, simply because she had suffered so many losses herself. Nathaniel was gone, but she had also lost 3 girls before age 10, one to childbirth, and her second youngest to a cancer of the breast when she was just 50. Only her oldest was left. There were grandchildren and great-grandchildren. She had her brother, Gabriel, though she hadn't seen him in a long time, for the simple reason that she would not go home to the village where she was born, and he wouldn't leave it. She was closest to her sister-in-law, Martha, who rode every week and did sometimes come to the city. And there were nieces and nephews and their families. But she felt the losses, and how could she not? She said, "Auntie, I was right here beside you when the worst news came. I'd like to think that I learned something from you, and that I have some of your strength." "That's just it," her aunt said. "That's the hardest part, being strong enough to let the hurt in and deal with it, and then let it settle in time as it will."
"Yes," Anna said. "I see that. I can make one promise at least. I will think of you and this conversation when things are hard, and try not to turn away from it."
"That's all I'm asking," said her aunt. "Now eat before you have to go off to the courthouse, or Mrs. Lee will scold me without mercy."
"I have a few more minutes," Anna bit into a sandwich, thinking. When she swallowed, she said, "You've been following the news about Janine Campbell in the paper."
"I have."
"The rumors are going around that she killed her boys." Aunt Quinlan had a particular look, one that said she was at the end of her patience, and it was there now.
"That's pure foolishness."
Anna swallowed another bite. "What do you think happened to them?"
"I can't say, but I do know that nobody is asking the real question, the important one. Ubi est Marbus?"
Anna laughed out loud to hear her aunt quoting the great physician Morgagni. "Where is the disease?" "Where did that old chestnut come from?" she asked.
"This family is chock full of doctors," her aunt said. "You know, when your ma and pa came to Paradise to take over Hannah's practice, they lived with us at first. And they did love to talk medicine. They did it over every meal. Sometimes your Aunt Hannah would be there, too, and they'd get into arguments and drag out books to prove each other wrong or themselves right. Nothing mean-spirited about it, mind. They were laughing half the time. And when they couldn't get anywhere with a case, one of them would put that question on the table. Ubi est Marbus? And they'd start looking at the evidence again from the very beginning. And most of the time they figured out what was going on, and more than that, why they had been looking in the wrong place."
"You're not asking me what disease Mrs. Campbell had."
"No. I'm saying that you have got to look and think symptom, not disease. If she's a symptom, then ask, where is the disease?"
And Anna knew 2 things. Her aunt was right, and she wouldn't be able to get it out of her head until she could talk it through with Jack. The courtroom was crowded and hot, and Sophie wished herself away, someplace where she wouldn't have to sit and listen to men talk about Janine Campbell. A woman they had never known and would never understand, not if her ghost came forward to answer their questions.
When the coroner announced that Archer Campbell was delayed, there was a great sigh from the reporters at the back of the room. Then he called Anna to the stand, and Sophie thought that they would have enough to write about once Anna started to testify. She took her seat across from the jury of men who were supposedly her peers. With the exception of Comstock, all of them dressed in somber colors and expensively tailored suits. Most of them had been reading journals or newspapers, but as she approached, Abraham Jacoby and Manuel Thalberg met her gaze and nodded, as colleagues greeted each other across a room. Dr. Lambert even raised a hand, which was a bit of a surprise. She couldn't remember ever speaking to the man, but apparently he knew Anna. The coroner left most of the questions to the physicians, and there were many of them. But Anna was a good teacher, and that carried over to her testimony. Even when Josiah Stanton asked the same question three times, like a particularly dull student, she stayed calm. She described her education, talked about medical school and work at dispensaries and clinics when she was an intern, about postgraduate work and the professors she had studied with in New York and abroad. Stanton wore an expression of unapologetic surprise that a woman physician should have such credentials. For a moment, Sophie thought he was going to challenge Anna, but then he thought better of it. And good for him. The coroner had only one real question for her. In your professional opinion, Dr. Savard, how did Mrs. Campbell die? Sophie appreciated the man's clarity and lack of melodrama, as did Anna because she answered in kind. Sometime late on Tuesday or early Wednesday, Mrs. Campbell attempted to induce an abortion on herself by means of an instrument as much as 10 inches long with a keen edge. In the process, she punctured her uterus and caused damage to other abdominal organs. Infection will have set in immediately, and once that happened, her death was inevitable.
Why would you assume that? Hawthorne asked.
Anna blinked at him, and really, it was a question that should need no answer. She said, Dr. Lister's and Dr. Pasteur's findings on antisepsis have been accepted by doctors and surgeons. Anna paused to look at the jury, her expression almost inviting someone to disagree. Morgan Hancock of Women's Hospital stared back at her, his mouth in a hard line. If he was going to challenge the very idea of bacteriology, they would be here a very long time. There was a pause, and he looked away. It is accepted, Anna repeated, that bacteria, which are too small to be observed by the human eye, are the cause of infection. Some types of bacteria are harmless or even beneficial, but there are also pathogenic bacteria that cause infection and illness. Bacteria are everywhere, but an infection starts, or can start, I should say, when pathogenic bacteria enter the body through a wound. Surely you're aware of the way President Garfield died. She stopped herself, because James Garfield's death was still a very controversial subject among doctors. If the coroner asked for clarification, there might be an extended debate. But he did not, and she went on. In Mrs. Campbell's case, she used an instrument that was not sterilized. In a well-run operating room, every object that comes in contact with a patient is sterilized, made free of bacteria by means of heat. Mrs. Campbell inadvertently introduced pathogenic bacteria of many different kinds into puncture wounds in the uterus and intestines. If she had come into any good hospital at that point, there's a chance she might have been saved if all the septic matter had been evacuated, but only a very small chance. Would any of the jury care to disagree with me? Dr. Hancock?
No,
Hancock said, his voice gruff. Anna allowed herself a small smile. As it was, the infection ran riot, so to speak. There was so much damage and so many different kinds of bacteria
The natural defenses of the body were simply overwhelmed. The result was a systemic infection, and the huge amount of pus and purulent matter found in her abdomen. When she was brought to the New Amsterdam, she was near death following from cryptogenic pyemia, blood loss, and shock.
But you operated anyway.
I didn't know the extent of the damage until I had her on the operating table. She died not 5 minutes after I made the first incision.
To be clear, you agree with the post-mortem report on the cause of death.
I agree on the cause, but I do not agree about the agent. The post-mortem reads, "Person or persons unknown performed the operation." I am fairly certain that it was Mrs. Campbell who operated on herself.
What makes you so sure of that?
Stanton asked.
For my part, I am not convinced.
Anna sat up straighter and looked at him directly. I have treated many women who came into the New Amsterdam after a poorly done abortion. Some of them will say, in the vaguest way, that they went to someone for help. No one has ever volunteered the name of a practitioner.
An abortionist,
Anthony Comstock interrupted. As you like, Anna said, without looking at him. You may condemn those people who perform operations, but they are generally technically skilled. Some are less particular about hygiene, which is the cause of most complications in such cases. There was nothing skilled about the operation performed on Mrs. Campbell. It was clumsy, even violent. For a full 10 minutes, she answered very specific questions about the surgery and Mrs. Campbell's condition. When the jurors began to argue among themselves about definitions, Hawthorne interrupted.
Dr. Savard, it is your opinion that Mrs. Campbell operated on herself in such a violent way that she caused fatal injury. You believe that she could have done such a thing on her own, though she was not a very large woman.
Mr. Hawthorne, she said, Mrs. Campbell ran a household, did the scrubbing and cleaning and laundry. Have you ever lifted a tub of wet linen? She didn't lead a pampered life. She gave birth 4 times and miscarried 2. She was not frail. Whatever thoughts or emotions motivated her to such an extreme act, she was determined and capable, and she persevered through the pain, as women do every day. In your place, I would want to know what drove her to such a point that she saw no other option than this drastic procedure she performed on herself.
Well, I can think of another question.
Comstock's voice rose over the steady murmuring in the gallery. He looked out, Sophie thought, to make sure he had everyone's attention.
How would a simple, uneducated woman know what to do? Where did she get the knowledge and the surgical instruments she used? Did she have some text or instructions to follow? Maybe something like the pamphlet that was found in her dresser drawer. Female Health and Hygiene. Are you familiar with it?
I'm willing to answer your questions, Mr. Comstock, but one by one. Could you start again?
I am Inspector Comstock, he said stiffly. And I'll start again, but at the end. Are you familiar with the pamphlet that was found in her dresser drawer?
I was never in her home, and I know nothing about the contents of her dresser drawers.
Come now, Dr. Savard. Are you familiar with the pamphlet we found or not?
I don't recognize the title, Anna said.
No? Well, if the coroner will permit me to show it to you.
Anna didn't wait for the coroner's opinion. She just held out a hand, looking Comstock directly in the eye. His mouth worked, puckering and jerking with pleasure he didn't try to conceal. He stood up to approach her, but the coroner's clerk stopped him.
I'll take it, sir.
Anna could not let herself smirk at Comstock, and so she smiled at the clerk and thanked him. She turned the pages of the pamphlet deliberately, slowly, and then handed it back to the clerk. I have seen pamphlets on hygiene, of course. Not this exact pamphlet, but others like it. Isn't it true that the hygienic measures described in that pamphlet are also used to induce abortion?
If there is a discussion of abortion in that pamphlet, I didn't see it.
That doesn't answer my question.
Anna decided to give him the information he so clearly wanted. She said, I have treated women who flooded themselves with lye soap, carbolic acid, rubbing alcohol, gin, quinine, bleach. The list is very long, and the results are often ugly. Women with a little more money sometimes take medicines. Most of them are nothing more than weak tea. Others are as bad as arsenic. Women try 3 or 4 times with such medicines and then seek help elsewhere. The very poor care for themselves. They use straws or wires or bougies, almost any kind of spoon or slender long instrument. Rubber tubing, metal probes, whalebone stays from old corsets. Your pamphlet addresses none of these things. And as far as I could see, it provided no instructions on terminating a pregnancy. Does that answer your question?
Comstock met her gaze with sputtering animosity. He said, I have no further questions at this time. Then let's move on, the coroner said.
Anna turned toward him. If I may suggest a solution to the question on the table?
Without waiting, she went on.
Dr. Lambert could speak to the question of how capable women are of injuring themselves. Dr. Lambert?
Lambert's whole face contorted with surprise, but he spoke to Anna directly. I think this point won't be settled without a second post-mortem. The remains? The Bellevue dead house? Said the clerk.
Anna sat back, clearly satisfied to have achieved exactly this outcome. The coroner seemed less pleased, but he didn't try to object. The jury would go to the morgue and the inquest would reconvene at 4.
Conrad leaned forward and touched Sophie's shoulder. Go with them, he said. Your testimony will be compromised if you don't.
Sophie inhaled a sharp breath. The idea of a second autopsy in the damp recesses of the Bellevue dead house was unwelcome. It wasn't so much the smells of putrefaction and mold, or the water that leached into the walls from the East River. Those things were never pleasant, but could be coped with. It was the idea of the men in the jury gathered around Janine Campbell, poking and prodding when she had been through so much already. But she would have to be there. With a female physician present, the others would be utterly professional and focused on procedure. She only wished she could ask Anna to come along, but it was too much of an imposition. Then help came from another quarter. Mary Putnam waved her closer, took Sophie's hand, and shook it firmly. Small and wiry, a plain woman who could be transformed and animated into something more when she had a medical issue to debate. Mary Putnam had also been one of their professors at medical school. Her expertise as a physician and a scientist was unquestioned, even by the most unapproachable male doctors. She was without a doubt the most exacting instructor Sophie had ever encountered. Together with her husband, they made a formidable team, and they were both here. Sophie reminded herself that she could reveal every facet of the Campbell case to Abraham and Mary Putnam Jacoby without hesitation or fear, because she had given the best treatment there was to offer.
I'm coming too, Mary Putnam said. The more female practitioners present, the better.
Will it be possible to keep Comstock out of the room? Sophie asked.
It will be possible, she said. I will see to it.
Sophie and Mary Putnam left with the jurors and the coroner to make the trip to Bellevue, while Anna stayed just where she was. She said goodbye to Conrad and his law clerk, and spoke to the friends who had come to lend support. But she never moved from her seat. Finally, the reporters approached her, and she sent them off with a sharp shake of the head.
She had no answers for them. But she did have an unanswered question of her own, one that had been growing in her mind since her aunt put it there. Ubi est morbus? It was the right question to put to the jury, and she had come very close to saying as much. Then Comstock had interrupted her with his outrage over that pamphlet, one he claimed to have found in Mrs. Campbell's dresser. Nothing Comstock had to say was a surprise, but the pamphlet had been something of a shock, because she really had never seen it before. From that fact followed two questions. What happened to the pamphlet Sophie had sent to Mrs. Campbell? And where had the one Comstock showed her come from? Which made Anna wonder what else she had gotten wrong from the start. It should have occurred to her that Mrs. Campbell would visit other doctors and midwives in the hope that someone would give her the help that Sophie would not provide. Contrary to what Comstock and the physicians on the jury seemed to believe, women in distress could find a way to end an unwanted pregnancy, so long as they could pay for it. For every case that came to public view because something went terribly wrong, there were 100 or more that remained a private matter. Though she had not said as much to Jack, Anna knew of 3 midwives and 2 male physicians who performed the procedure as a matter of course, and without ever having lost a mother. She knew another who was retired very well. Her own cousin Amelie had cared for women in the city for 40 years. It occurred to her now that she didn't know who had delivered Mrs. Campbell's first 3 children. More than that, it was possible, she admitted to herself, that in her desperation, Janine Campbell had put herself into the hands of a charlatan, one of the men and women who worked the darker corners of the worst neighborhoods, someone who took her money and promised results, but had not the slightest training or interest in anything but the coin to be had. Ubi est morbus? Janine Campbell's social standing and income made it unlikely that she had ventured into the tenements to find the help she needed. And so Anna found herself back at square one. By the courtroom clock, she saw that she had an hour and a half until the inquest reconvened. A lot could be done in that amount of time. And so she left, slipping through one of the side entrances onto the street, where she hailed a cab to take her back to the New Amsterdam. If she thought about something else hard and long enough, often the answer to a difficult question that evaded her would present itself. When Jack finally got to the New Amsterdam, he found he had missed Anna by a quarter hour. She had gone back to the Tombs, where the inquest was about to reconvene. Oscar hailed a cab, and they reached Judge Benedict's courtroom just as the jury took their seats. From their expressions, it seemed to Jack that they had not come to any kind of concord, which might mean another hour or more before the coroner closed deliberations for the day. Anna sat in her usual spot beside Sophie, both of them in conversation with another woman Jack didn't know. Conrad was listening closely while his clerk took notes. Jack followed Oscar to the back of the room to stand against the wall, the usual spot for any police officers who had an interest in a trial or inquest. He watched Hawthorne, who stood behind the bench, thumbs tucked into his vest pockets while he stared at the floor. His complexion had gone the color of old cheese, and even from the back of the room, the perspiration on his brow was obvious. Jack had the idea that he wouldn't be eager to watch another autopsy anytime soon. Hawthorne cleared his throat a number of times before he could be heard. I am going to poll the jury on a single question before we proceed. Gentlemen of the jury, on the basis of the evidence you have just seen, do you concur with the testimony of Dr. Savard, in which she stated her opinion that it was Mrs. Campbell herself who performed the operation to end a pregnancy? There was silence for a long moment, and then Abraham Jacoby spoke, his tone modulated and professional. He was not a big man, but his voice was deep and had a rasp, as was sometimes the case with men who were too free with tobacco. His German accent was strong, but there was nothing in the least inarticulate about the way he expressed himself. He said, "I agree with Dr. Savard that the operation was done in a violent way, and I find it hard to imagine any practitioner, even a new or poorly trained one, who could have done such damage. For those reasons, I am satisfied with a ruling that identifies Mrs. Campbell as the cause of her own death." Three of the physicians followed this lead, but the rest of the jury, Comstock the most vocal, did not. They wanted to hear the rest of the testimony, especially that of Mr. Campbell himself. "Given the missing Campbell boys," Stanton said, "it seems sensible to interview the father, especially." "Very well," said Hawthorne. "As Mr. Campbell is still out of the city looking for his sons, we will continue with Dr. Sophie Savard Verhoeven." The whole room seemed to lean forward as Sophie left her seat and approached the dock. Even when she had taken her place, there was an expectant hush. Jack had the idea that they would be disappointed if they were looking for drama. Sophie was utterly calm, her expression neutral. She wore a gown of leaf green, some kind of figured brocade, Jack thought, cut loose in the style his sisters called rational. For some reason, he had never been able to pinpoint. The only jewelry she wore was a brooch at her throat and most probably a ring or two, but like Anna, she hid her hands with gloves. Her manner was polite and professional as she answered questions. There were a lot of them, far more than Anna had gotten from the jurors, and they were more personal, about her childhood and the reasons she came to New York, her experiences of the war. Abraham Jacoby changed direction and asked her a very specific question about her training as a doctor, and she answered those questions with more warmth. "You are in private practice," Stanton said to her, not a question by his tone.
"I am attached to the New Amsterdam and the Colored Hospital as well as a number of clinics and infirmaries," she corrected him, "and I am sometimes called to consult on difficult cases."
Stanton gave her a doubtful look. "Oh, really? And who calls on you for your," he paused, "expertise?"
Just a flicker of anger on Sophie's face, but before she could answer, the doctor who ran the German dispensary spoke up.
"She has consulted on a number of cases for me," he said, "and with great success."
Stanton made a muffled, disbelieving sound, and Thalberg took the chance to say more.
"Dr. Savard Verhoeven is especially skilled when it comes to problematic presentations. I have seen her manage deliveries I thought impossible. She is also an excellent diagnostician and professional in all her dealings."
Before the conversation could be taken any further, Hawthorne interrupted. "In that case," he said, "I would like to hear Dr. Savard Verhoeven's diagnosis of Mrs. Campbell's condition."
The room was very silent while Sophie considered, her gaze on her own folded hands. Finally, she looked directly at Hawthorne and spoke to him alone.
"She gave birth to a healthy boy when I attended her on Easter Monday. Her labor was long but not particularly difficult. It was her fourth full-term delivery, and she coped quite well. The word diagnosis is used when there is some kind of disease or injury. A woman who is pregnant and gives birth without trouble is not ill or injured in any way. What I can say is that I noted symptoms of extreme melancholy and even depression in Mrs. Campbell after the birth of her son."
"And that is unusual."
"Not in and of itself," Sophie said. "Women react in different ways to giving birth. But Mrs. Campbell was very forthright about her feelings."
"She told you she was unhappy?"
"Yes."
"In what way?"
Sophie paused.
"She talked about her husband's insistence that they have six boys. The idea frightened her because she believed he would not..."
She cleared her throat.
He would not desist in his attentions until he had reached that goal. She said it was a competition he had going with his brothers.
Which brothers? Asked Comstock, as if to catch her up in a lie.
She didn't say, Sophie answered him. She only said his brothers.
Did she tell you she was frightened?
Asked another juror, the one with the beard the color of tobacco juice. She said that it would kill her to have another baby so soon, that she couldn't bear the thought.
She was asking you for contraceptives, Comstock announced to the room.
Yes, Sophie said. She was.
And you gave her...
Nothing, Sophie said quietly. Because of the laws that forbid me to provide her with the help she needed, I gave her nothing, and now she is dead.
She is dead because she violated the laws of God and man,
Comstock shot back at her.
She reaped the terrible harvest of her sins, and somebody helped her, at least as far as providing the information she needed. Was it you?
Conrad stood to speak, his voice projecting easily through the room.
My client has rights under the law, and I am here to see that they are protected.
Hawthorne said, Mr. Belmont, I assure you, we see eye to eye on this matter. Now, Mr. Comstock, Dr. Savard Verhoeven has not been accused of any crime, nor is there any evidence to indicate that such an accusation is forthcoming. Mind your manners, sir.
I will mind the word of the Lord my God, thundered Comstock. I will mind the laws of this great country. You, sir, are in no way equal to either of those authorities.
But I have been appointed coroner, and this is my inquest, said Hawthorne mildly. If you will not desist, I will remove you from my jury, and that I swear to God.
Comstock's whole body was shaking in anger. For a moment, Jack wondered if he would lose his infamous temper and be thrown out. But then he took his seat and crossed his arms over his chest. Sophie said, I am happy to answer the question. I did not give Mrs. Campbell contraceptives of any kind, nor did I give her information on how to end a pregnancy. I did remind her that the law would not allow it.
Abraham Jacoby said,
And when she came to your office a month ago?
Yes. At that visit, she was convinced that she had already fallen pregnant. She may have been right, but it was far too early for any clinical signs.
The man from Bellevue leaned toward her. You did a thorough manual examination? What were your findings exactly?
I observed no changes to the cervix or the uterus. Changes to the breasts would be difficult to determine as she was still nursing. But there was ample evidence of recent sexual activity, in line with the history she gave me.
Hawthorne wanted clarification, which made all the doctors in the jury shift uneasily. Sophie didn't seem to notice.
Mrs. Campbell told me that her husband resumed sexual activity almost immediately after she gave birth. She used the phrase morning and night to describe his attentions.
Coroner Hawthorne!
A man in the gallery struggled to his feet with the help of a cane.
There is a question in the gallery, said the clerk. Your name, sir?
I am a retired physician. Cameron. James McGrath Cameron, and I do have something to say. I cannot believe that a woman is allowed to speak of such private matters in a public court of law. What a man does with his wife in the privacy of his home is no one else's concern or business, and certainly not a matter for discussion here by a woman no less. Shame on you, sir, for allowing it.
With a triple thump of his cane, he sat down again.
Hawthorne cleared his throat. Dr. Cameron, the witness is a fully trained and qualified physician, and she was answering a question put to her by another physician. That is why we are here, to look at the evidence, all the evidence. That is why the general public has not been allowed admission. If you find it disturbs your sense of propriety, I suggest you leave this courtroom now."
Cameron jumped up again and began to make his way up the aisle toward the exit, stabbing down with his cane with each step.
"I will do just that," he said, his voice rising. "But I want it on record that I protest. Such things are not discussed in public. I am going home to my supper. I wish you a good evening."
The door closed behind Dr. Cameron before the sentence was out of Hawthorne's mouth. He let out a deep sigh.
"Dr. Savard Verhoeven," he said, "I assume you are familiar with the concept of puerperal insanity."
Sophie agreed that she was.
"Have you ever seen a case in your own practice?"
"I have seen women lose touch with themselves and the world after a difficult birth. Sometimes a woman will exhibit behaviors that would generally be regarded as insanity. While in training, I observed a patient who was so disoriented after the birth of her third child that she was confined to an asylum, primarily because she imagined that God was speaking to her so loudly and insistently that she couldn't sleep."
"And what became of that patient?"
asked Hawthorne.
"She is still in the private asylum, to the best of my knowledge."
"And tell us now, did you see any such symptoms, Mrs. Campbell? Please take your time in answering if necessary."
"I don't need time to consider," Sophie said. "I can tell you that Mrs. Campbell was greatly distressed, desperately unhappy, and that she was consumed with anger. But she was in her right mind."
"Consumed with anger?"
asked Stanton, a queer half-smile on his face.
"Consumed with anger at whom? Her husband? The father of her children?"
"Yes," Sophie said simply. "Mrs. Campbell was very angry at her husband. I saw no evidence that she was a danger to herself or her sons, but I would not have been surprised to learn that she hurt her husband. In her mind, he was the source of all her troubles. And to be truthful, Dr. Stanton, I see a good deal of logic in her view of things."
"What a remarkably opinionated young woman you are," said Stanton. "Truly remarkable for someone of your sex and station and origins." "I concur," said Comstock. "You should be glad that this jury does not sit in judgment of you, Mrs. Verhoeven." All right, Hawthorne. Dr. Verhoeven, now I've got one last question."
Oscar was muttering under his breath. "I'll knock his little rat teeth down his throat if he insults her again."
"You'd have to beat me to it," Jack said. "Look, he's got that damn pamphlet out. He's like a dog with a bone."
Sophie looked up from the pamphlet the clerk had handed to her. She said,
"No, I am not familiar with this pamphlet."
"But you are familiar with other pamphlets of this kind."
Sophie looked at Comstock for a long moment, her expression thoughtful.
"Certainly," she said finally. "I can show you an example if you like. This pamphlet," she drew some folded pages out of her reticule, "this pamphlet was written specifically about methods to inhibit conception."
Comstock's mouth fell open in surprise, and so Sophie turned to Hawthorne.
"Shall I go on?"
Said Hawthorne. "Well, please do," said Jacoby. "I'd like to hear."
Sophie smiled broadly, and while Jack could not see Anna's face, the way she held her head made him think she must be smiling too, as a number of the women in the gallery were smiling.
"It's a very professionally produced piece, as you can see. 12 pages with illustrations. The very kind of pamphlet that Mr. Comstock works so hard to keep out of the hands of the innocent. Right here it opens with the proclamation that prevention is better than cure. And it goes on.
Vaseline charged with 4 to 5 grains of salicylic acid will destroy spermatozoa without injury to the uterus or vagina.
She looked at Comstock, her expression utterly grim. This pamphlet has been in circulation for a few years, I believe. Has your office been successful in breaking the company?
She looked at the cover of the pamphlet as if she were searching for something elusive.
Yes, here. Colgate is the company that makes Vaseline and printed this pamphlet on contraception. Have you brought Samuel Colgate to court and charged him with violation of your Comstock laws? But wait, isn't Samuel Colgate the president of your New York Society for the Suppression of Vice? That must put you in a difficult position, Mr. Comstock.
The reporters were scribbling as fast as they could, while the murmur of voices in the gallery grew louder. In the jury box, the physicians were waiting, brows raised for Comstock's reply. But there was none forthcoming. For once, Anthony Comstock had been struck dumb. He sat utterly still, except for the tick that appeared at the corner of his mouth, fluttering and jerking.
Mr. Comstock, Hawthorne asked, and then, after a long moment, if this line of questioning is finished, I have an announcement. The officer of the court has brought a note that says Mr. Campbell is returned to the city and will be able to testify here tomorrow afternoon. I hope that his testimony will be enough to allow the jury to reach a conclusion in this matter. And now we will adjourn. It's already 6.
Jack lost sight of Comstock as people began to leave the courtroom. Oscar said,
I can't believe she had the courage to ask him that question. I'd like to buy her a drink. She sat up there with a straight face and asked Comstock whether he had arrested one of the richest men in the city. Samuel Colgate marched into court by Comstock. Can you see it? She's got guts, he said again, and pulled out a handkerchief to wipe his eyes.
She has guts, Jack agreed. But at this point, she also has nothing to lose.
Anna took Sophie by the elbow and pulled her in for a hug. It was very unlike Anna, and Sophie was both surprised and pleased.
I thought you'd decided not to do it, she said, but you timed it perfectly.
It was harder than I imagined it would be, Sophie said, once he was looking at me, but it needed to be done. Maybe it will have some positive effects, if the newspapers dare to print it.
She looked up to see Oscar Maroney beaming at her, with Jack just behind.
Well done, said Detective Sergeant Maroney. I thought Comstock would have a stroke right there in front of God and man. Well done.
Jack was smiling too, but with less obvious enthusiasm. Anna poked him.
You don't approve?
Oh, I approve, he said, catching her poking finger and folding his hand around hers. I just hope he lets it go and doesn't cook up some scheme to pay you back.
That's why I wouldn't let Anna do it, Sophie said. There is not much he can do to me now, is there?
Anna was looking around herself.
For once, I would happily talk to a reporter, and they are all gone.
Off to file a story about Samuel Colgate, the contraceptives peddler, said Oscar. By God, I can't wait to see that.
Sophie had the Verhoeven carriage waiting. Jack wanted to hail a cab, but Anna wanted to walk. She sent Sophie home and considered Jack's unhappy expression.
Are you so tired, she teased him, that you can't manage a half hour's walk?
He narrowed his eyes at her. And if I weren't here, you'd walk home on your own.
Anna studied the street for a moment. There was a dead horse in the gutter at the corner of Franklin, the carcass at least a week old. A crowd of boys were busy wrenching out ribs to be used as swords. One of them already had his, and used this advantage to poke a playmate in the belly. They fell into the gutter beside the horse, fists flying. Anna would guess them no more than 8. She said,
I could lie to you.
One brow went up, which was disagreement enough.
In the early evening, when it's still light, Broadway is safe enough. I might have walked home alone.
He took her bag from her and offered his free arm. You're lucky you still have your skin, Jack said. They walked along quietly for a moment. Anna kept one eye on the brawl, which was attracting little boys from every hidey hole, all of them battering wildly at one another, crashing into the carcass of the horse and climbing out again.
Do you want to volunteer to clean up their battle wounds?
No, Anna said. That would be a mistake. I learned that lesson soon after I qualified. Stay out of arguments.
He wanted to know more, and Anna didn't mind telling stories that showed her to disadvantage, at least not with family and friends. And Jack, she reminded herself, was both. A girl of about 17, I think. She came into the New Amsterdam with some cracked ribs and a broken nose and 2 black eyes. I guessed it might have been her father or husband, and I was trying to think how to ask. Jack hummed under his breath. When her sisters came rushing in, looking almost as bad. She had stripes on both cheeks. Anna held up one hand, the fingers bent into a claw shape. There was a clump of hair missing from her head above her left ear, too. Do you know the strength it takes to rip out hair like that?
I've never tried it, Jack said dryly, but I've seen it done.
She was screaming and spraying blood from a split lip with every movement of her head. The sister on the examination table almost levitated. She just launched herself, or she tried to, but I put my hands on her shoulders to hold her down. Jack was listening, but she couldn't read his expression. She might have put a rib through a lung. That's what was going through my head, she went on, and I just acted on that basis. And I said to the sister who had come in, stop this nonsense immediately. It didn't have quite the impact I thought it would.
Yes, Anna shrugged.
They both started screaming at me, the one on the table for speaking to her sister rudely, and the other one for treating her sister roughly. If an orderly hadn't come in, I think they might have joined forces to teach me a lesson. She let out a small laugh. And from that I learned not to put myself in the middle of a fight. I call for the orderlies instead.
Sensible, Jack said. Do you know what they were fighting about?
Money, said Anna. It's almost always money, unless the patient comes in drunk. Then it can be about anything. The color of the sky, the name of the president, the month of the year. Broadway was crowded with street vendors and delivery wagons, newsboys and clerks on their way home for the day. An elderly woman with a back so crooked that it forced her to stare at the ground had turned her head sideways to barter for a measure of dried beans. Her voice was cheerful, and she was grinning at the man who scowled down at her, because Anna could see she was about to get the best of him. It was the end of the day, and he wouldn't want to drag unsold wares home.
Really, though, it's always about money, Anna repeated. Even when it seems not to be.
Jack's eyes were scanning the street, as if he were expecting to be confronted and didn't know from what direction it would come. Anna said,
You deal with the worst of humankind day in and day out. It makes you doubt everybody.
I don't doubt you, he said. The first minute I saw you, I knew you were a good person.
Because I was treating orphaned children.
Because you stood up to that nun, Sister
Ignatia. She made me angry.
That was obvious.
It was about the children who weren't vaccinated. Vaccination is free at dispensaries all over the city. She made a decision based on her own fears and superstitions,
and put children at danger. There's no excuse for such ignorance.
I got that, too.
She drew a deep breath and waited for her pulse to stop racing. So you were attracted to me because I stood up to a nun?
I was impressed. Attraction had to do with other things.
Anna waited, wondering what she was hoping to hear. He said,
Your hair is hard to overlook, the deep color of it, and the way it curls even when it's rolled up on the back of your head. It's always fighting to be free. While you were leaning over one of the children, I saw a curl escape from the pins and fall behind your ear along the line of your throat. You have a beautiful neck, Anna. I had an almost uncontrollable urge to tuck that curl back into place.
Embarrassed, she said, I thought I'd never see you again when I left the ferry.
Really? Jack looked down at her. I was busy trying to figure out how to make sure you did.
You were not.
I was. And then there you were, not 12 hours later, going in to Alva Vanderbilt's monstrosity of a new house. You took my breath away.
All along her spine, nerves jumped. She was afraid to raise her head to look at him.
This damn city, Jack said. No place for a man to kiss his wife without an audience.
Jack Mezzanotte, Anna said, her voice catching. I never took you for a coward. Maybe that wasn't such a good idea, Anna said when they had walked another block. My knees have gone all wobbly, and my pulse won't slow down. Her hand was trembling a little, but then so was Jack's. He rubbed a thumb over the juncture of wrist and palm, the silk of her glove whispering. He said,
Take this off.
No.
She pulled her hand away with a jerk. Now who's the coward?
Her brows pulled down in irritation, but she stripped the glove from her hand and looked at it and then at him, as if she had never seen such a creature before.
Jack held his jacket open. Put it here, in the inside pocket.
He wondered why he felt the need to provoke her on South Broadway, of all places, but her jaw was set now, and she was not going to back down. Standing very close, she tucked the glove into his pocket, the one that rested just over his heart. She was looking him in the eye as she stepped back and let her hand trail down his vest front, like a blade of grass being drawn over his skin. Her hand continued downward, and he grabbed her wrist to stop her.
Very funny.
Both dimples came to the fore. I thought so.
Just wait, Jack said, until I get you home.
Anna felt fevered, though the evening breeze was cool. When the house came into view, her heart was beating so fast that she could feel it in her eardrums. She thought of the people she loved and cared for, who would want to talk to her and feed her and hear about her day, and she wondered if she could just be honest. Say something like, Jack and I will be back in an hour. Don't hold dinner for us.
But the very idea made her throat go dry with anticipated embarrassment.
Because, of course, they would know why and what and even how. But it could not be avoided, and so she turned toward the garden, where everyone would be on a beautiful afternoon like this. Then Jack stopped her by pulling her closer. He pointed with his chin in the other direction. What?
Something to show you.
Now?
Right now.
They climbed the front stairs to the new house. Weeds, Anna reminded herself. Everyone is calling it Weeds. And she waited while he fished a key out of his pocket and opened the door. In the hall, he put her Gladstone bag down while Anna peered around, feeling oddly shy about exploring. Even from where she stood, she could see that someone had been hard at work. Everything from the ceiling to the floors had been scrubbed clean, the old paper scraped from the walls and the floors sanded and polished. The air smelled of lye soap and wax and something else familiar.
What is that?
Lemon, said Jack. My mother believes in the cleansing power of lemon.
Then he was tugging her up the stairs. They'll be waiting dinner for us, she said, holding back.
They can wait a while longer.
Jack, he raised a brow. I don't have my...
With a sigh, he picked her up and carried her, taking the stairs two at a time. He walked straight into the largest room, the one that would be theirs when they finally moved in, and opened the door by leaning into it.
Oh, Anna said.
The walls had been cleaned and painted, the floors polished, and new curtains hung at the windows, simple cream-colored linen over white lace panels. There was a large four-poster bed, neatly made with plump pillows and a beautiful white-on-white quilt. There were two dressers and a table. An earthenware jug filled with white roses and lilac was the only decoration, placed on the mantelpiece over the small fireplace, and two chairs angled toward each other in front of it. It was all very simple but pleasing. Jack dropped her onto the bed.
When did you manage all this?
I don't think that's what you mean to say. He let his jacket fall to the floor and started unbuttoning his vest. What you mean to say is, oh, well done. Anna reached up and pulled him down to her by tugging on a suspender.
Well done, she said against his mouth, but I still need my cervical cap.
He kissed her so thoroughly that she lost her train of thought. Jack reminded her by leaning over to open a drawer on the bedside stand. He brought out a familiar box.
You are far-sighted, she said. Very resourceful. Now, do you know what to do with it?
And a quick study, too, she said as he pulled her underneath him 10 minutes later. She was already flushed, damp with perspiration, and a little embarrassed, Jack thought. She arched against him, gasping. He leaned down to suckle the curve of her throat and tasted soap and salt and Anna. She was wriggling, undulating around him, pinned down by the simple fact of his possession, wet and hot and very tight, and Jack thought he would lose his mind if he didn't start moving in her immediately. But he held off, nonetheless. The heel of her hand struck him above the ear, and he laughed, pleased with her and himself.
Jack, she said, struggling, lifting against him. Jack!
So impatient. His mouth moved up her neck to her ear and the flesh underneath it, pulsing warm. He pressed the flat of his tongue there and felt her whole body tensing around him, a clenched fist dragging at him.
What are you waiting for?
She was irritated with him, and he found, just now, he liked that. He kissed her mouth, soft and wet and greedy. You don't like this?
You rotter.
Her feet slid up his legs, pressed his thighs. She dug her heels into the small of his back, arching to the exact angle he had been waiting for, the one that gave him the last inch he needed so that he could settle, finally, where he needed to be. Too much. He rocked against her, and she put her head back and groaned, a hoarse sound that made goose flesh rise all along his back. Anna, too much.
Jack, don't coddle me.
She could still shock him, a kind of seduction all its own. He set out to test her resolve and his own limits. Jack's parents were at the dinner table, and Anna was stuck between them, caught in the web of their curiosity and ready affection. She desperately wanted to at least change her shirt waist, but they had come in late. It would be rude to ask people to wait any longer. She just wished she could be sure she didn't smell too much like, well, what she must smell like. She had little appetite, but filling her plate was something to do while she talked to Mrs. Mezzanotte, who wanted to know about weeds, which she had seen earlier in the afternoon. Anna didn't look at Jack, but she knew he was grinning.
"It's a fine house," his mother said, "and it will be beautiful when it's finished."
She had some furniture she thought would suit, and would send it to town the next time there was a greenhouse delivery.
"Nothing elaborate," she said.
From her tone, Anna got the idea that Celestina and Bambina had explained to their mother that Jack's new wife had austere tastes. She thought of linen curtains fluttering in the breeze and hoped her blush wasn't too obvious.
"You will have to come to Greenwood before much longer," Mrs. Mezzanotte said, "or your new sisters-in-law will hunt you down."
In her surprise, Anna let out an awkward laugh. "That sounds ominous."
"Strong-minded women," said Mr. Mezzanotte. "I married one, and so did all our sons. The noise sometimes."
He put down his fork and placed his hands over his ears to rock his head from side to side.
"Incredibile."
He winked at the little girls and said,
"Come di cento scimmie."
"Stop," said Mrs. Mezzanotte. "They aren't as bad as monkeys."
"Yes, they are," said Jack. "But we love them anyway. All except Benedetta."
"Jack,"
his mother gasped.
"She's so bossy,"
Jack said. "Of course, so is Mariangela. I'm not sure which one would win a bossy cow contest."
"First monkeys and now cows," said Mrs. Mezzanotte. "Stop."
But she was smiling.
"Neither of them would win that contest," said his father. "The prize would go to Susanna."
Mrs. Mezzanotte's mouth made a perfect O for three heartbeats, and then she shrugged, conceding the point.
"Susanna," she said. "No doubt about it."
She turned to Anna.
"We'll scare you off."
Aunt Quinlan laughed.
"Not our Anna," she said. "She's made of sterner stuff than that, and she likes strong-minded women."
"Because I was raised by them," Anna agreed. While Mrs. Mezzanotte talked at more length about her daughters-in-law, each of whom she clearly liked and loved, Anna was listening with half an ear to Leah as she told Jack a story, waving her fork in the air like a baton. Italian spilled out of her in a rush. Rosa grabbed the fork out of Leah's hand, her mouth pursed in disapproval.
"Non parla inglese al tavolo, è maleducato."
Leah blinked, her face solemn.
"Come si dice maleducato in inglese?"
Aunt Quinlan said,
"Rude. The word in English is rude."
Leah grabbed her fork back from her sister with a wrenching motion and thumped it on the table, tears brimming and ready to fall.
"It's not rude. Italian is not rude. Everybody should speak Italian. If I have to speak Italian and English, then everybody else should speak English and Italian."
She put out her lower lip in a thunderous gesture of rebellion and cast an accusatory look around the table, daring someone to disagree. Before Rosa could stop sputtering long enough to answer, Anna said,
"You know, Leah, you're right. Aunt Quinlan speaks Italian, and you speak Italian, and everybody here speaks Italian except me and Margaret."
"Margaret is learning Italian," Rosa said, almost under her breath.
"Then I had better catch up,"
Anna said. That got her one of Margaret's rare wide smiles.
"In the meantime, I don't want you to have to keep a story to yourself if you only know it in Italian, so go right ahead."
Aunt Quinlan reached over to put a hand on Leah's head.
"And listen now, my henny. The next time you have a point to make, you can do it without shouting and people will still listen to you."
Leah wrinkled her nose, as if she doubted this bit of wisdom. But she also nodded. Reluctant acceptance, Anna thought. She wondered how long it would last.
So I'll need an Italian tutor, Anna said.
Both girls raised their hands, and so did Jack. She elbowed him, not too gently.
I was hoping you'd volunteer, she said to the girls, but I'm going to need more help still. I've got somebody in mind. I'll bring him by for you to approve.
Jack looked at her doubtfully, and Anna kept her smile to herself.
That night when they went to bed, Anna told Jack the story of how her parents met. My mother went to New Orleans to study medicine with Uncle Ben's brothers, because they ran a clinic there and took on students. This was long before Dr. Blackwell, the one who founded Woman's Medical School, long before she fought the battle to be the first woman admitted to medical school. Women who wanted to study medicine had to apprentice.
Have you told me about your Uncle Ben?
Anna pointed to a particular portrait. Ben Savard. He met Aunt Hannah when she was in New Orleans during the War of 1812, and they settled in Paradise. Ben's half-brother, Paul, was the head of the clinic, and my mother studied under him. Aunt Hannah thought he would be the best teacher for her, because he wouldn't put up with her nonsense, but he also wouldn't take offense when she turned out to be smarter than everybody else.
Was she?
Smarter than most, I think. So Ben's brother, Paul, had a son who went to France to study medicine. That was Henry Savard, my father. My mother was 2 years into her studies in New Orleans when Henry came back from Paris, qualified in medicine and surgery, too. He wasn't happy to find that my mother had taken his place and had won everybody over. My mother took exception to him, too, at first.
And they fell in love and got married, Jack prompted.
It was a stormy romance, or so the story goes. But yes, they fell in love and got married. By that time, my Aunt Hannah said there were more people in Paradise than she could doctor, and so my parents decided that they'd move north and practice medicine with her, which is what they did. The tree frogs were making music outside the window. For a long time, they lay listening. And then Anna roused. She said, "What about your parents?"
He stifled a yawn. "That's a story they tell every year on their anniversary. I think you should wait to hear it from them."
"Is that an Italian custom?"
"A family custom, I'd say. You might want to think about the story you'll tell when the time comes."
And then he fell asleep, as if he hadn't just handed her an assignment to worry over for the next 11 months. Chapter 28. New York Post, Wednesday, May 30th, 1883.
Archer Campbell returns without his sons. Testimony goes on 2 hours. Mr. Archer Campbell, whose wife died under mysterious circumstances last week, has returned home after a fruitless search for his 4 missing sons, ages 2 months to 5 years. He last saw the boys the day before their mother's death, when she took them away from home and out of the city to a destination and fate as yet undetermined. The complete and unexplained disappearance of 4 young boys has occasioned considerable speculation from all quarters. The suggestion that Mrs. Campbell might have harmed her sons was addressed in Tuesday's testimony, taken during the inquiry into her death. Dr. Sophie Savard Verhoeven, the last physician to treat Mrs. Campbell, contends that her patient did not suffer from puerperal insanity. The medical men on the jury were not all in accordance with this view. In an interview, Dr. Stanton expressed his doubts to the Post. "Well-brought-up women who become good wives do not break with the habits of a lifetime for no reason. Mrs. Campbell had an excellent husband and a fine home. She was a caring and attentive mother. It is possible that her physicians did not look closely enough to see the evidence of puerperal insanity before it was too late, or that she was unduly influenced in a way not yet discovered.
New York Tribune, Wednesday, May 30th, 1883. Letters to the Editor.
Sirs, the coroner's inquest currently underway in the matter of Mrs. Janine Campbell's death reveals the true nature of those who campaign for women's rights, and it can be summarized in a few words. They think they know better. In this inquest, female doctors have given testimony. They speak in rough terms about unladylike, lewd topics, naysaying their betters simply because they are female and they know better. Nature has decreed a certain division of labor, but they know better. The founders of this great nation set out rights and responsibilities for its citizens, but the women tell us they know better. The truth is that gentle, worthy ladies brought up in Christian households have their rights already. Good women have the right to influence the race in the nursery, in the family, in the school, and thus through all the race of life. They have the right to be respected by all the respectable. They have the right to be tenderly loved by all whose love is worth enjoying. They have the right to be protected and provided for by men. Healthy, God-fearing women take pleasure and joy from the rights accorded to them by the Almighty. If you doubt the dangers of women's rights, you have only to observe the way female doctors behave when they are called to give testimony. It is a scandal and a tragedy for them and for the nation. A concerned physician.
Anna said, "Of course you should sail, Sophie. If the district attorney says you are free to go..."
"Wait," Sophie said. She paced from one side of Anna's office to the other. "There was something in the paper this morning that has me worried. Did you see Clara's letter?"
"I haven't had much time to read the papers these last few days."
She took the clipping that Sophie handed her and looked at it. Another letter to the editor.
"Sirs, in his tireless compulsion to rid the city and state of all material he finds personally distasteful, Anthony Comstock of the New York Society for the Suppression of Vice seems never to sleep. We note that in 2 days he has arrested 4 people for the sale of obscene literature, as well as a printer he suspects of printing such materials, raided a reputable and well-respected art dealer, and impounded paintings by one of the greatest artists now living, again because in his superior opinion they are inappropriate and immoral. In addition to all this, he serves on a coroner's jury in the tragic case of a young woman's untimely death, using that opportunity to insult and attempt, note, sirs, I say attempt, to bully female physicians. We find it outrageous that Anthony Comstock is permitted to use the justice system to harass people engaged in lawful business, and worse still, to pass judgment on the way qualified physicians treat patients in crisis. Note, too, that Comstock discreetly looks the other way when one of his colleagues on the board of the Society for the Suppression of Vice manufactures, advertises, and sells the contraceptives he and the Society find so personally and morally disgusting. It is high time Mr. Comstock's antics in and out of the courtroom be curtailed. Dr. C. E. Garrison, Secretary, Association for the Advancement of the Medical Education of Women." Anna looked from the newspaper clipping to Sophie and back again. "I wondered if the papers would allow Samuel Colgate's name to be printed. Vaseline is the smallest part of what they manufacture, and the papers won't want to lose the advertising revenue. I realize it's disappointing."
"Not that," Sophie said. "The part about the printer. Comstock has arrested a printer suspected of supplying immoral materials."
"Oh," Anna said. "I see."
"I went to Clara first to see if she had any information, but she had inquired at the Tombs and couldn't get a name. Do you think Jack could find out?"
Anna said,
I should think so.
I can't just walk away and leave the reasons at the mercy of Anthony Comstock.
Her voice wobbled in a way decidedly unlike Sophie's usual calm appraisal of even catastrophic events. After a moment's thought, Anna cleared her throat.
But you would trust the matter to us, I hope. With Jack and Oscar, I think we can certainly get to the bottom of this.
And if it is Sam Reason who has been arrested, I'll ask Conrad to represent him. Them.
The Reasons might have a lawyer of their own, Anna said, but they shouldn't have to bear the cost.
Anna sat down and pointed to the other chair. After a moment, Sophie took it. She drew in a deep breath and let it go in a sigh.
He was terribly rude to me, Sophie said, but he was also painfully honest.
Sam Reason's grandson?
She nodded.
I realize that there is only so much that can be done. Who knows what evidence Comstock has, or thinks he has, but I want to be sure that Sam Reason gets the very best representation. And Anna, this is important.
Anna waited while Sophie tried to collect her thoughts.
He is very proud. It's important to me that he not feel condescended to or patronized.
I understand, Anna said, though she did not completely.
So this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to leave a bank draft for expenses, a large bank draft. Use all of it, and if you need more, send me a telegram and I'll arrange it.
She got up suddenly, looking at the watch pinned to her bodice.
I need to get home to Cap before the inquest.
I think you could reasonably stay away from the tombs, Anna said. Tomorrow at this time, you'll be boarding the Cosimo, and there are more urgent things to be done.
Absolutely not. I owe Janine Campbell that much. I will see the inquest through to the end.
Anna got to her feet and hugged her cousin.
And so will I.
Jack listened to the whole story attentively, his expression giving away nothing of his thoughts. The more Anna saw of him in his professional guise, the more she realized how very much like a doctor he had to conduct himself. He gave nothing away, just as she would give no indication of her findings if she were to examine his mother or one of his sisters. They were standing on the steps of the tombs. All around them, reporters were trying to get Anna's attention, but Jack's posture, his protective stance, kept them from coming closer. The crowd was very large today, no doubt because Archer Campbell was actually here. Anna had caught sight of his red head going into the building and would give testimony. Whatever delay had been keeping the entryway blocked suddenly cleared, and Jack propelled her into the lobby. The uniformed officers nodded to him and touched their hats to Anna. She recognized one of the men from their visit to the Brooklyn Bridge and was glad not to be able to stop, because she knew that questions would be asked, and what she would have to answer. So she let herself be guided down the hallways and up the stairs to the courtroom. Jack leaned over to speak to her without being overheard.
I'll find out what I can about the printer now. It may take a while, but I'll be back here as soon as possible.
He brushed a kiss across her ear, and turning away, disappeared into the crowd in the hall. The inquest was already being called to order when Anna took her seat next to Sophie. She got out her lap desk and writing paper and pencil, and while the coroner went on about the purpose of the inquest, she wrote Sophie a note.
Cap.
Sophie took the pencil and wrote,
"Looking forward to sailing tomorrow."
Anna could imagine that very well.
Cap would be desperate to get away not so much for his own health, but for Sophie's well-being.
Sophie wrote,
"The printer, Sam Reason."
Anna thought for a moment and took back the paper to write, "Jack has gone to find out." Sophie gave her a relieved smile. And then Archer Campbell was taking the witness seat. He looked drawn, with shadows in the hollows of his cheeks and under his eyes, so dark they might have been bruises. His expression was grim and even angry.
"Mr. Campbell," the coroner began, "my deepest condolences on the sad loss of your wife. You've had no success in locating your sons, I take it."
"None," Campbell said.
"I am sorry to hear it. If that's the case, you'll call an end to this charade and let me get back to the search."
Hawthorne looked almost startled. Anna thought he was going to challenge Campbell's less than veiled insult, but saw him think better of it.
"We'll get right to it, then.
Tell us, please, about your wife and how you came to marry."
With obvious displeasure, Campbell told the story in as few words as possible. In Bangor, on post office business, he had been introduced to a young lady who worked in the dead letter office. Her family background was not ideal, but she was healthy, a good Christian, and a hard worker. After 2 weeks' courtship, when he had returned to New York, he had decided to marry her.
"She married with her family's blessing."
A ghost of sour smile moved across Campbell's face.
"Five unmarried daughters, they were glad to be shut of her."
"I see. Mr. Campbell, can you shed any light on the events that led to your wife's death?"
Campbell's jaw worked silently for a moment. Then he said,
"I don't know anything about the particulars." "Did you realize that she was with child?"
"No."
"She didn't speak to you of it?"
"She never talked about such things. Wouldn't be proper."
"When did you first notice something was off?"
Campbell seemed to relax a little. Maybe he had been expecting accusations and realized now that there were none forthcoming.
"The house," he said. "It was out of order when I came home from work on Tuesday evening."
Campbell shifted in his chair.
"That was unusual?" "She knew nothing about keeping house when we married. But then, from what I've seen of French Canadians, they don't put much value on cleanliness. I had to teach her what it means to keep a house, the way my mother had. A place for everything and everything in its place. No fingerprints on the windows or anywhere else, for that matter. Floors polished, stove blacked, laundry cleaned and pressed and mended. Good plain food on the table when I came through the door. Waste not, want not. Children who know their place and don't speak lest they're spoke to. But that day, as soon as I came in the door, I knew there was trouble. The boys were sitting at the kitchen table like so many poppets. Big eyes, like they knew they had a hiding do. My oldest boy was holding the baby, trying to keep it quiet."
"If you'd just go on," said the coroner. "Tell the story as it comes to you."
Campbell frowned.
"There's not much to tell. She had lost track of time, she said. She had a headache. She got headaches now and then, but my belief is you work through the pain. Don't let it get the best of you. But she did. That Tuesday night, she did. Put cold meat and bread out, something I wouldn't tolerate normally. A man needs a hot meal. But I made do. She cleaned the kitchen, took care of the boys, and sat down with the mending."
"Did she say anything about arrangements for the next day?"
"She asked if she could take the boys to my brother's farm."
A flush of color appeared on Campbell's cheeks.
"So she could get the house cleaned proper. I almost said no, and by God, I wish I had."
Anna could almost hear the unease around her in the gallery. Most of the onlookers had been disposed to feel sympathy for Campbell, but his brusque manner was making that difficult. Even Comstock looked unnerved.
"She seemed unwell that Tuesday evening."
"As I said."
"You didn't call a doctor."
"Rich people call a doctor for every little thing," he said. "The rest of us make do. She said she'd be right in the morning, and I believed her. And so she was. Now I'm thinking nothing failed her at all. It was just her way of putting me off the scent, not asking about things being out of order.
Hawthorne gave a doubtful low hum.
Tell us about that Wednesday morning.
Campbell didn't try to hide his impatience.
She went about her business as she always did. Breakfast and seeing to the boys and so forth, getting them ready for the train.
Did you see her off at the Grand Central Depot?
Look, Campbell said. It was nothing out of the ordinary. I went to work. She got herself and the boys to Grand Central by omnibus. I don't hold with cosseting. My mother raised 6 boys to good men, and she did it with the Bible in one hand and a hickory switch in the other.
All right, said Hawthorne. His tone was short.
Then we'd like to hear about Wednesday evening when you got home.
She was in bed, Campbell said, vomiting into a basin, curled up under the covers.
So I got my own dinner, cold meat again, and read the paper like I always do. I heard her moving around some, and so I went to check, and she was trying to get a bottle of laudanum open. I opened it for her, and I went back to my paper and then to bed. That was at about 9.
Did Mrs. Campbell wake in the night?
I slept in the boys' room. It was her idea, thinking I shouldn't catch the bug that had her so sick.
From the jury, Dr. Stanton cleared his throat.
You didn't notice blood, I take it? There would have been a great deal of it.
Campbell looked distinctly uncomfortable.
She told me she had her monthlies, and I left it at that.
Abraham Jacoby said, Were you disappointed to hear that Mrs. Campbell's menses had started? For the first time, Campbell looked confused.
I don't follow you.
We heard testimony that you were hoping to increase the size of your family as quickly as possible. Something about a wager with your brothers. The news that your wife wasn't with child then. Was that a disappointment?
Beside Anna, Sophie went very still, while Campbell's neck and face flooded with color.
That's a private matter. Who told you that? Whose testimony?
Mr. Campbell, said Hawthorne. Please answer the question. Campbell's head was turning as he scanned the gallery, moving from face to face. Sophie sat quietly, composed, unwilling to let Campbell read anything from her expression once he found her where she sat.
Mr. Campbell?
He turned back to the coroner with clear reluctance.
I wanted a big family, he said. She knew that before she married me. She wanted the same.
Dr. Talberg said,
She never expressed doubts.
Doubts?
Campbell fairly spat the word out.
What do doubts have to do with anything? Man proposes, God disposes, so goes the saying. A woman raised right knows that and accepts it as her duty.
But the evidence indicates that Mrs. Campbell performed an abortion on herself, said Hawthorne.
If that's so,
Campbell said with great deliberation,
then she lied to my face and she's burning in hell where she belongs.
There was a moment of shocked silence in the courtroom. Jacoby said,
Where do you think your sons are? Do you have any sense of what's become of them?
Campbell's whole face contorted.
If what you're telling me about my wife is true, then I'd put nothing past her. Maybe she stole away and killed them, to spite me.
Anna felt flushed with heat. Whatever they had imagined about Janine's home life, it had been far worse. Casual cruelty and callous indifference could destroy a woman as effectively as fists.
Then let me ask one more question,
Abraham Jacoby was saying.
Assuming for a moment that your sons will not be returned to you, did you have no idea that your wife held you in such contempt, that she was angry enough with you to do such unspeakable things?
Campbell stood up suddenly, and so did Anthony Comstock.
The man is not on trial, Comstock said. You are making grave accusations without the least bit of evidence.
Your own tactics, Comstock. Come home to roost, noted Dr. Talberg.
I beg your pardon, Comstock bellowed. How dare you?
Sit down, Mr. Comstock, and remember the seriousness of this inquest, said Hawthorne. Mr. Campbell, you too sit down immediately.
He paused to take a deep breath.
You may find Dr. Jacoby's question insulting, Mr. Campbell, but it is a reasonable question. If your wife was so deeply unhappy and disturbed enough to do the things we're talking about, where did those feelings originate?
Finally, Anna thought. Finally.
The debate went on and on, it seemed to Anna, but nobody in the gallery moved a muscle. It was as good as a theater production, one with an excellent director. Her opinion of Mr. Hawthorne grew to considerable proportions as she watched him play the jurors off each other and off Campbell, stepping in exactly when things began to escalate too quickly, providing small jolts when things began to lag. On her pad, she wrote, no history of mental illness she admitted to, and French-Canadian, and save the rod. Mrs. Campbell did not approve of harsh physical punishment, it seemed. Her husband offered this as evidence of her deceptive character, because, he suggested, there was nothing gentle about a woman who could wrong him the way she had. Anna had had more than her fill of Archer Campbell when the coroner declared the inquest at an end and cleared the courtroom of everyone but the jury. The hallway, already crowded with reporters, doubled in density. In the tumult of the crowd, Anna stayed very close to Sophie, her Gladstone bag bumping against her leg as people pressed forward around islands of reporters who stood scribbling madly on paper held open against a palm. Perspiration was running down her back and sides, and she had never wanted to see an open window as much in her life as she did at that moment.
Sophie Verhoeven,
a reporter pushed in front of them, his face lowered so that the brim of his hat would have touched Sophie's forehead had she not shoved him away.
Don't you want people to know?
What I want, Sophie said, is for you to remove yourself immediately, immediately.
Anna took her by the arm and pulled her aside.
Jack, there.
He was easy to spot in a crowd, a head taller than the tallest man. Anna gave a very solid push in his direction, and Sophie followed.
Let's go, Jack said.
He used his body to create a protective wall, a passageway that moved with them. He opened a door and gestured them into another hallway, this one empty and dim and cool. Anna leaned against the wall for a moment to catch her breath. Sophie stood very stiffly, her mouth pressed hard shut and streaks on her cheeks that had only one origin.
Oh, Sophie.
Anna put a hand on her cousin's elbow, and Sophie turned to her and pressed her face to Anna's shoulder and wept as though the world had ended. To his credit, Jack stood back and let them be. Anna smiled wanly at him over Sophie's head.
She should have killed him, Sophie said finally, and saved herself.
Anna fumbled a handkerchief out of her sleeve and wiped Sophie's damp face.
In a just world, yes.
She felt very close to tears herself until she saw Jack's face.
What?
He said. Sophie, Sam Reason and his grandmother are waiting in a room just down the hall to talk to you. Sophie stiffened.
You was arrested?
Jack nodded. But he won't be charged. He's free to go home.
What? How?
Comstock overplayed his hand. And he's not the only one who knows people in the district attorney's office. Sophie, be warned. Reason is...
Rude, I know, she said. But he has cause.
Delilah Reason was thinner than she had been, her cheekbones more prominent, and the shoulders of her shirt waist not quite so well filled out. But her smile was genuine,
and Sophie was so glad